she never wanted her husband, her epileptic sister, or her new friends and in-laws to think her less than content. He imagined her coming occasionally across an old acquaintance, and the awkward conversation that would ensue, especially if she happened to be accompanied by her husband. He imagined her reaching for a sheet of stationery, the beginning of a letter on her mind, and then hesitating, and finally giving up the idea altogether. She would not want to agonize the recipient with the decision whether to respond, nor would she want to anticipate a reply, and then finally have to admit to herself one was never coming. Not to mention the stars. The girl who wanted a telescope of that particular description wasn't content merely to view the craters of the moon or the rings of Saturn. She wanted to see the mountains of Mars, the very outer reaches of the solar system. Why would she deprive herself of everything that mattered to her when she could easily... He stopped his thoughts from going any further in that direction. Instead, he hurled his walking stick onto the seat she had vacated and cursed her obduracy and stupidity. Chapter 6 Louisa had not told Lord Renworth everything about Mr. Charles, the butcher who fancied her. Mr. Charles was indeed a good man and an excellent butcher, but he had a brother who drank and gambled and often came to him with one hand outstretched. He also had a widowed sister who depended heavily upon him to support her and her two young children. So even if he were desperate to marry Louisa, he would have to think twice, thrice, about taking on an invalid sister-in-law who needed looking after round the clock. And suppose Mr. Charles somehow overcame his own qualms. Could Louisa really marry him? There was an enormous difference between marrying a man one did not love wildly and marrying a man while wildly in love with someone else. Who'd have thought at the beginning of the year that she had such a capacity for trouble? Everyone, herself included, had believed her the most placid, most level-headed girl on earth, or at least in their part of the Cotswold. Had anyone told her that she would be brought low by romantic love, she'd have snickered. Had that sage prophet warned her about sexual infatuation, she'd have laughed hard enough to crack a rib. And yet, here she was. "Louisa, won't you do us the honour?" asked Lady Balfour. "Yes, of course, ma'am." Louisa rose from her corner and poured tea for the latest batch of callers. Wednesday was Lady Balfour's at-home day. This afternoon callers were particularly numerous due to the large dinner Lady Balfour gave 2 days ago. The women in their fine afternoon dresses stayed precisely a quarter of an hour, barely sipped their tea, and rose to pay their respects at the next house. Louisa's embroidery needle moved slowly, absently. 5 days had passed since the carriage ride with Lord Renworth. It was now the second week of July, and words like cows and Scotland were being thrown like grains of rice at a wedding. People were making plans for the end of the season, for where to go next to amuse themselves. The end of the season. She ought to worry about the future, but like a lovesick girl half her age, she thought of Lord Renworth instead. Would she ever see him again after she left London? 10 years, 5 years, or even 12 months down the road? Would he remember her with a pang of regret or a mere shrug? Whether anyone else noticed her distress, she could not say. In the middle of June, Lady Balfour had confidently predicted proposals by the first week of July. That particular week had come and gone with no matrimonial commitment from anyone. Lady Balfour, however, remained as ebullient as ever about Louisa's eventual success. "Have I told you our story from last week?" she smugly asked her guests. "No, of course I haven't. I've been saving it for today." It was past 4 o'clock. Those now occupying the drawing-room were Balfour intimates, whose long-standing friendship with the hostess gave them license to stay a bit longer than the allotted 15 minutes. "Recall, if you will, the torrential downpour of a few days ago," Lady Balfour continued. "Quite ruined the hemline of my walking dress, it did," said Lady Archer, who had known Lady Balfour since before the Queen was on the throne. "Precisely. That afternoon my dear Tenwessel needed to bring Miss Cantwell home from the bookshop, but rain came all of a sudden. He was stranded at his club without a conveyance. There were no hackneys to be had, and, of course, in a cloudburst of that magnitude, he couldn't simply pitch an umbrella and walk." "Indeed not," concurred Mrs. Constable, who had gone to finishing school with Lady Balfour. "Tenwessel fretted. You know how seriously that man takes his obligations. But no sooner had he spoken aloud Miss Cantwell's name, then a knight in shining armour stepped forth. Or perhaps I should say, a knight in a shining town-coach." Mrs. Titherley, Mrs. Constable's sister, exclaimed softly, "My goodness, do you mean to tell us that it was Lord Renworth again?" Lady Balfour preened, "I do indeed." A small crescendo of oohs and ahs rose. "We all know that boy protects himself beautifully from adventurous misses. Yet your Miss Cantwell had him for a dinner, a dance, a long walk at a picnic, a drive home on a rainy day. Have I missing anything?" asked Mrs. Constable. "No, ma'am," Louisa hurriedly said. "Oh, but I must differ," said Mrs. Titherley. Louisa's head snapped up. "I ran into Lady Avery at the modiste's this morning, and she told me that her nephew, Mr. Baxter, had seen Miss Cantwell and Lord Renworth seated together in a refreshments room at the British Museum a while ago, though Mr. Baxter, being a man, had not bothered to mention it to her until very recently." "Louisa!" exclaimed Lady Balfour, almost making Louisa prick her finger. "Mr. Baxter didn't know any better. But why have you not brought it up either?" "It was the merest coincidence," Louisa protested. At least this time she wasn't lying. "I certainly never thought to see him there, and I dare say the same for Lord Renworth." "The meeting might have been a coincidence, but Lord Renworth could have simply nodded and moved on. That he sat down at your table was indisputably a conscious choice." "I cannot agree more," said Mrs. Titherley. "Furthermore, taken as a whole, I feel quite strongly that so many occasions cannot possibly all be coincidences. There must be some design to it on Lord Renworth's part." "I say whether it is design or coincidence, you are one lucky young lady, Miss Cantwell," opined Lady Archer. "In fact, you might prove to be the luckiest lady in London, if this current course holds." "I do not mean to disagree with you, Lady Archer, but I—" The rest of Louisa's argument never saw the light of day. As the drawing-room door opened, and Lady Balfour's footman announced, "His Lordship, the Marquis of Renworth." The four older women in the room, with identical expressions of surprise, eyes wide, jaws slack, swung to face Louisa, who stared back at them similarly agape. Lord Renworth strolled in, looking relaxed and stylish in a dove-grey Newmarket coat. Louisa closed her mouth and bent her face to her embroidery frame, trying not to stab herself as she pushed the needle through the velvet silk. Afternoon courtesy calls were those threads in the fabric of society woven almost exclusively by women. Given that Lady Balfour ran no salon and belonged to no fast set, the presence of a man at this feminine place and hour, when he should be snoozing off his post-luncheon stupor at his club, was extraordinary. What did he want? A theatrical rendition of normalcy was put on. Lord Lord Renworth was offered a seat. Fresh tea was called for, and comments on the weather, a bright afternoon for once, were exchanged all around. Some of the ladies were better actresses than others. Lady Archer was a natural, chatting about her meteorological apparatuses at home, her husband being very particular about the measurement of rainfall and of atmospheric pressure. But none of them were as good as Lord Renworth, who made it seem as if he took tea with ladies of his mother's generation every Wednesday during the season. He asked after Lady Archer's son, currently on a tour of the continent. He inquired into a fence of Lady Titherley's, which had apparently been giving all sorts of offence since the previous autumn. And he brought up the subject of Lady Constable's hybrid roses, which quite surprised and flattered the latter. Even Louisa had no idea that she experimented with new varietals. Was it possible that he had come on a whim? Perhaps he missed her a bit. Perhaps he missed her more than a bit. And perhaps he happened to be nearby and decided that he would rather cause brows to rise than go another day without seeing her. She grimaced at her dangerously self-indulgent thoughts. More evidence of her besottedness, that. The old her would never have woven an entire tapestry of starry-eyed amour out of spools of a man's sexual curiosity. The clock struck 4:30. He had been in Lady Balfour's drawing-room for 10 minutes, 5 minutes left before etiquette dictated that he take his leave. She wished she could understand what went on behind those hypnotic eyes of his. The man would not cause rampant speculation without a good reason. But if that good reason existed, she could not fish it out of the chaos in her head. "And they are truly excellent on an arbour," Mrs. Constable said, with a flutter of her hands, imitating the motion of a climbing rose. "In a few years you will have a profusion of blooms, exceptionally lovely in early summer."
"I will be sure to pass on the knowledge to my head gardener," replied Lord Renworth, looking for all the world as if he had nothing in mind except summer roses.
"I can have mine send the design for the arbour too, if you like," offered Mrs. Constable, a little breathlessly.
"It will be most sincerely appreciated, my dear Mrs. Constable."
He smiled at the older woman, and Louisa could feel her own heart pitter-patter. Now Lord Renworth reached for his tea, poured by none other than Lady Balfour herself, and took a sip. A small silence descended, and extended, as Lord Renworth unhurriedly ate a piece of Madeira cake, seemingly unaware of the breathless anticipation building in the drawing-room. Louisa doggedly wielded her needle. Push, pull, push, pull, while her heart thumped like a war-drum in the middle of a battle. Finally, Lady Balfour could stand it no more.
"Now, would you care to divulge what brought you here today, Lord Renworth? It can't be just to sample my Madeira cake."
Lord Renworth set aside his plate.
"Had I known how excellent your Madeira cake is, Lady Balfour, I would have presented myself at every one of your at-home days this season. But you are right. I did come with a different purpose in mind."
Lady Balfour's voice rose perceptibly.
"And that is?"
Another small silence. Louisa, her eyes fixed firmly to her embroidery frame, imagined him turning toward her, studying her with that sometimes inscrutable look of his.
"With your permission," he said, "I would like to speak privately with Miss Cantwell."
She neither dropped her embroidery frame nor poked herself with the needle. Such clumsiness would have required the ability to move. She only stared straight ahead, unable to believe what she was hearing.
"Louisa, Lord Renworth wishes for a word with you."
Lady Balfour's voice boomed in her ears.
"Show him to the morning parlour, won't you?"
And then to Lord Renworth,
"We expect her restored to us in 10 minutes, sir."
Louisa carefully set aside the embroidery frame and rose, looking only at the floor before her, a proper display of modesty, she was sure, except she did not feel bashful, only flabbergasted. she preceded Lord Renworth to the morning parlour. The moment he closed the door, she spun around.
"Have you lost your mind? What do you think you are doing? Those women in the drawing-room are expecting a proposal of marriage. What am I to tell them when you leave? No, ladies, his lordship does not wish to take me for a wife. He merely wanted to hear me recount another one of my unseemly dreams."
He drew close. She noticed for the first time the understated swagger of his gait, that of a man who'd always had everything he wanted. "Have you been having more of those dreams?" he asked, speaking into her ear. She shivered as his breath brushed her skin, and the woods after a thunderstorm scent of him. She wanted to bury her face in his neck and inhale for all she was worth.
"Of course I have, but that is not the point. The point is that—"
"Narrate one of your unseemly dreams."
Was that the pad of his thumb tracing the line of her collar? She could barely feel it for the electricity racing along her nerve endings.
"Now?"
"We still have a good few minutes. Why not?"
"Why not? I will tell you why—"
Her voice trailed off as he undid the top button of her blouse. She gawked at him, her throat closing with both fright and thrill.
"What are you doing?"
"What does it look like I'm doing? Do as I say, or I'll keep opening your blouse." She blinked, not sure whether she wanted him to stop. He laughed softly. "My God, don't tell me you want me to go on."
"When have I ever given you the idea that I wouldn't want you to go on?"
He shook his head.
"You give me no choice." "Fine, I'll ask nicely. Please tell me one of your dreams, my dear Miss Cantwell."
She swallowed.
"That isn't nice enough. You have to say, my dear Louisa."
He looked at her strangely for a moment.
"Won't you please, my dear, dear Louisa?"
Her name on his lips was pure music. She wanted to hear it again and again.
"My dear, dear Louisa."
"For the past 3 nights, I have dreamed that we are riding in a carriage together, a town coach not unlike yours, except it is made entirely of glass, even the floor, and I'm naked."
His eyes were a deep, dark green, almost wintry, like a pine forest in December, yet his gaze was all volcanic heat.
"Go on."
I fret about my nakedness. So you fashion a blindfold from your necktie and tell me that if I cannot see out, then I will not worry about those who might be peering in.
Impeccable logic, that. What happens next?
Once I'm blindfolded, you touch me with something. You say it's your walking stick, but I'm not sure I believe you.
Why the doubt?
Because it is hot. Her face scalded. And please don't ask me what happens next. There is no next.
In her dreams, she simply carried on in that state of horrified arousal. He smiled slightly.
"Do you like it when I touch you with my not walking stick?"
She could see her hand reaching up, but she could not quite believe what she was doing, even when she had a lock of his hair between her fingers.
"In my dreams there is nothing you do that I do not like."
"It's worth abducting you from Lady Balfour's drawing-room before a full crowd of onlookers, just to hear that."
"Dear God, Lady Balfour and all her friends! Please tell me that wasn't what you came for."
"Of course not. I came to tell you that I have decided to rescind my offer. The idea has run its course and expired."
The contents of her skull imploded. She couldn't think. She couldn't see. She couldn't breathe. He wasn't a good man, and she hadn't cared. She was willing to overlook any number of staggering faults, as long as he felt at least something of what she felt for him.
when he had been toying with her all along. As if from a great distance away, she heard herself say, "You might as well, I suppose. I never would have cheapened myself by accepting that particular offer." It was a lie. She would have hated to become his mistress, because it would mark the beginning of the end. But she had never, at any point, eliminated the choice from consideration.
"You don't look as righteously vindicated as you ought to," he pointed out, his voice insidiously soft, insidiously close.
"Rest assured, my immortal soul is pleased. It's only my vanity that is crushed."
And her pathetic heart.
"My poor, darling Louisa," he murmured, "the evil, evil man. It is still very ill done of you to come here and single me out, just to tell me you thought better of your nefarious plans. What am I supposed to tell Lady Balfour in—" She glanced at the clock. "Precisely 45 seconds."
And once those 45 seconds flew by, once he walked out Lady Balfour's door, she might not ever see him again. Who else would like her for her scheming ways? Who else would applaud her for thinking of herself? And who else would ask her about the telescope she had loved and lost? He touched her face. But to her horror she realized he was only wiping away her tears.
"You may tell Lady Balfour that in exactly 3 weeks you will be married."
She stared at him through the blur of her tears.
"To whom?"
He only looked at her as if she were a very slow child who couldn't grasp that 1 + 1 = 2.
"I don't understand," she said,
though understanding was beginning to penetrate her woolly brain.
"What is there to understand? I have made you an offer of marriage. Will you take it, or must I rescind that offer too?"
Suddenly she felt as if she'd drunk an entire gallon of coffee. Her fingertip shook.
"Of course I will take it.
I came to London to marry the largest fortune I could find, and there is none available larger than yours. But why would you marry me?"
"Because young ladies who confess to pornographic reveries ought to be rewarded with riches beyond their dreams?"
But that made no sense at all.
"I don't—"
"Our 10 minutes are up," he said,
buttoning her blouse and wiping away the rest of her tears, his fingers sure and warm.
"I will not allow any eclipsed second to besmirch my sterling reputation. Time for us to return to the drawing-room, Louisa."
He was already turning away when she gripped his hand.
"Kiss me. Shouldn't you at least kiss me when you propose to me?"
But when she opened her mouth, out came, "I still want my house and my £1,000 a year for the duration of my natural life. And I want those conditions written into the marriage settlement." He tilted his head. She could not tell whether he was vexed or amused.
"You do?"
She gathered her courage. "If something seems too good to be true, then it probably is. For all I know, you are secretly readying your solicitors for an annulment as soon as you've tired of me."
"Such a cynic."
"Better be unromantic than thoroughly used and still poor." He took her chin in hand.
"And if I refuse?"
"Then I will tell Lady Balfour that I turned down your proposal."
She could scarcely believe it, but she was extorting the most eligible bachelor in London.
"I will give you a house and 500 a year, he countered.
Her heart was in her throat.
"I won't marry you for a penny less than 800, and it had better be a house with at least 20 rooms.
His fingers cupped her cheek. The pad of his thumb rubbed against her lips. His gaze was cool and severe, and she was suddenly in a panic.
"No, no, it's quite all right. I will marry you for 500 a year and a hovel. In fact, take my mother's pearl brooch. Take my great-aunt Imogen's jet pin. And you can also have the emergency money I've hidden away at home, all £11.08 of it."
He smiled.
"You will pay for this. You know that, right?"
The way he looked at her, so much wickedness, delight, and camaraderie.
If she hadn't been born with the constitution of a horse, she would have fainted from both relief and a tsunamic surge of sheer happiness.
Yes, she whispered. Yes.
1,000 yeses. Chapter 7. Louisa's life changed from the moment Lord Renworth declared to a roomful of breathless ladies that Miss Cantwell had consented to become his wife. Within the crisp, freshly ironed pages of the next day's Times, she found the engagement announced with all due pride and gravity. An hour later, an enormous bouquet of pink-tinged white orchids arrived at the house, courtesy of her husband-to-be. At noon, more evidence of his regard, a magnificent diamond ring made its dramatic appearance, sending Lady Balfour into a swoon of ecstasy.
"What did I tell you, Louisa? What did I tell you?"
Notes of congratulations snowed upon the house, along with invitations to every event taking place from then to the end of the season. Louisa spent two entire days answering the well-wishers. When she went on calls with Lady Balfour, amidst many an envious and sometimes incredulous look, much fuss was made of her. The luckiest lady in London. Louisa herself was no less staggered than any of her well-wishers. She giggled when she was alone. She gaped at her ring whenever she caught sight of it. Sometimes, as she lay in bed at night, she pummeled her mattress with both hands and feet, as gleeful and irrepressible as a child about to go on her first holiday. But other times her dumbfoundedness took a more sober turn. Clearly his proposal took place, but with each passing day it made less sense. A mistress was a temporary feature in a man's life, a passing fancy to be discarded or replaced any time he so chose. A wife, on the other hand, was a permanent installation, almost as irrevocable as a mother. What could possibly have induced him to make such a decision? She had a healthy regard for herself, but even if she esteemed herself 10 times as much, she still couldn't comprehend what it was about her that had proved irresistible to a man who could have had any woman. The tentative explanation she cobbled together was a discomforting one. He enjoyed wielding power over her. Almost from the very beginning, he had intentionally set out to disrupt and destabilize. She'd had to fight back for every inch of footing she could command, so that she was not entirely at his mercy. It was possible that even with her resistance, he'd come to the conclusion that he would never hold greater sway over a woman. Or perhaps it was precisely her resistance that he relished, that in spite of it, he could still prevail over her as much as he did. She often thought back to the moment their engagement first became reality, that flash of euphoric happiness that he liked and wanted her enough to pledge his name and all the privilege that came with it. But the fact remained that she could trust him no more now that he was her fiancé than when he had been merely a devious and amoral would-be lover. When they were married, she would not try to deny his dominance in the bridal bower. In that particular arena he would probably always render her breathless and helpless. But that was the only weakness she would ever admit, lust of the body. Her mind would remain her own, and her demented and slightly shameful love she would carry as a secret to her grave. It was the only path through the dangerous and, some day, very possibly heartbreaking terrain of her marriage. Louisa's epic success brought her family to London. Their departure from home was delayed 2 days by Frederica's continued refusal to leave her room. Frantic telegrams arrived for Louisa, who cabled back, "Tell Frederica Lord Renworth has the means and the connections to make her skin marble smooth again." Whether anything in the world could accomplish what she promised was immaterial. At 27, Frederica was still a head-turningly beautiful woman. Her problem had far less to do with dermatology than with perception. "Your task when they arrive is to make her feel as lovely as the first star in the sky," she told Lord Renworth. It was the first time they had seen each other since the day of their engagement. She'd been quite buried by the work that came with mounting a wedding in 3 weeks, of the magnitude and splendour required by his station in life.
"What?" he mock exclaimed. "I am out a 20-room house plus £800 a year, and I have to play the swain to the sister-in-law too."
He looked both commanding and delicious standing by the window of Lady Balfour's drawing-room, bathed in the light of the afternoon. She was proud one moment, covetous the next, and then fearful the moment after that. It would always be like this, wouldn't it, being the wife of a man she loved but couldn't trust, whose true motives were as murky as the bottom of the sea? "It will save you, well, me actually, money on milk bars and exotic emollients later."
"And why would I want to save you money?"
He rounded to the side of her padded chair and looked down at her.
"Wouldn't I prefer it if you had to spend it all and come begging for more?"
She stared at his lips. He had not kissed her, ever. She would like him to, but she refused to ask. She even held back from reaching out and touching the hand he braced on the back of the chair. It was one thing to try to undermine his mastery of the situation with unwholesome speech and action, quite another to betray heartfelt desires that only further strengthened his hand. "I couldn't spend £800 a year if I tried."
"Don't let anyone hear you speak like that. My reputation will never recover if it is known that I married a woman who can make do with £800 a year. Besides, what will I have to complain about at my club if my wife isn't suitably spendthrift?"
My wife. A wife could be the object of unabashed adoration, or simply another nuisance in a man's life. Where would she fall along that continuum?
And would his, if not black, then at least darkish grey heart, ever be hers?
She folded her hands together primly. "Does no one complain about their wives being too insatiable in bed?" His gaze swept her entire person. Her skin tingled. He wanted to do wicked things to her. It was the reaction she had hoped to provoke. But he touched her nowhere, not even the fabric of her enormous sleeves. He took a seat opposite hers, his long legs taking up most of the space between them.
"Are you planning on being an overly enthusiastic wife?"
The way he studied her both absorbed and unsettled her. "Would you like me to be?"
"I am much more interested in the wife you cannot help being," he said, the firm last word on the subject.
He wanted to strip her bare in every way. Her naked body was only the beginning. From there, her undisguised thoughts. At last, her unhidden heart. She took a sip of her tea, her fingers tight around the handle of the cup. "So, will you promise to shamelessly flatter Frederica?" 2 days later, as Lord Renworth strolled into Lady Balfour's drawing-room to meet Louisa's family, there was a reverent collective intake of breath, as if the Cantwell women were a group of mortals who had accidentally stumbled into the presence of Apollo himself. Louisa too felt as if she were seeing him again for the very first time, her eyes blurring with the potency of his physical perfection.
"You, sir, are a scoundrel."
As if he'd heard her thought, he glanced her way. Their gazes held. A pair of miscreants recognizing each other in a room full of upstanding people. It lasted only a moment, but the sweetness of that secret communion lingered, a joy that was also an ache in her heart. They were two of a kind. She wished she wouldn't need to always guard herself from him.
"May I present his lordship, the Marquis of Renworth?" said Lady Balfour, still giddy from having pulled off the most spectacular match, or mismatch, as Louisa sometimes thought of it, in years.
"Sir, my dear cousin Mrs. Cantwell, Miss Julia, Miss Matilda, Miss Cecilia, and Miss Cantwell."
Frederica, addressed as Miss Cantwell, as she was the eldest, kept her head lowered. Lord Renworth approached her chair. She still sat with her head down. Much to the surprise of everyone present, he lowered himself to one knee so as to be level with her. Flustered, she turned her entire body to one side. He studied the ankle she presented him, then calmly rounded to her other side. Lady Balfour and Mrs. Cantwell both glanced toward Louisa, who could only shake her head to show that she had no idea what he was doing. He straightened.
"I understand you have been mourning the loss of your beauty for years, Miss Cantwell. What I do not understand is why your family has allowed such an act of rampant narcissism."
Frederica looked up in shock.
"The only imperfections I see are a few shallow pockmarks on your right cheek. I would never have permitted any sister of mine to brood over such minor blemishes for the better part of a decade. Had you come for a London season, you would not have dislodged Mrs. Townsend from her perch as the most beautiful woman in London. You might not even have disturbed Miss Bessler's place third on that list. But make no mistake, you would have been mentioned in the same breath as those women. Instead, you have wasted your youth grieving for a gross misfortune that never took place. You are perhaps 5% less lovely than you would have been without the pockmarks, not 50%. Miss Louisa asked me to compliment you, but I shall not. Not when you can go out and garner hundreds of them on your own with minimum effort. And if you will not, then there is nothing anyone can do for you. The matter is not with your face, but your head."
Without waiting for a response, he moved on.
"My dear Miss Matilda, did you have a pleasant trip?"
If anything, Louisa had expected a charm offensive, and a charm offensive this was not. He acted as if he'd never encountered such a ridiculous thing as Frederica considering her looks ruined. It was ridiculous, except Frederica refused to believe her family when they tried to convince her otherwise, certain that her mother and sisters were lying out of love or pity. But Lord Renworth's simple, almost brusque repudiation of the truth she'd long held to be self-evident had a far more dramatic effect on her. By the time he was saying his goodbyes, Louisa caught Frederica looking surreptitiously at herself in the mirror hanging over the fireplace, when she'd studiously avoided any reflective surfaces for years upon years. She was not the only one who noticed.
"Did you see that?" asked Cecilia,
as soon as Frederica and Lord Renworth were both out of earshot.
"I saw that," Mrs. Cantwell exclaimed. "Think of the wonderful match she can still make for herself, if only she would go out and let herself be seen. There is bound to be a rich widower somewhere who would be thrilled to marry her."
"Now, why didn't we talk to Frederica like that earlier?" said Cecilia.
"We did," Matilda pointed out. "We talked ourselves blue in the face. We said everything Lord Renworth said. We just didn't say it the way he did."
Lady Balfour nodded authoritatively.
"And the way he said it made all the difference."
Mrs. Cantwell turned toward Louisa.
"I hear they call you the luckiest lady in London, my dear. I think you must be the luckiest lady in all of Britain."
That same general sentiment prevailed. Matilda, with whom Louisa shared a room at home, was the only one to say, before they went to sleep that night,
"I know everyone else is saying how lucky you are, Louisa, but I think he is the lucky one. Just think how much Mr. Charles will envy him in having you for a wife."
Louisa reached over and hugged this most beloved sister.
"Thank you, my dear. I hope you aren't only marrying him because we need the money," said Matilda. "You do like him, don't you?"
Louisa had never asked herself that question before.
Fortunately or unfortunately, depending how one looked at it, the answer was all too obvious. She did like him, his villainous ways included. In fact, his villainous ways might be the very reason she liked him so much, this darkly gleeful secret that he shared only with her. "Not only do I like him," she answered, "I would have volunteered to be his mistress if I couldn't be his wife." That sent Matilda into a fit of giggling. She hugged Louisa back.
"I am so glad to hear that. I am sure you will make him very happy, and I hope he will do the same for you."
Louisa had her doubts. She had no idea what made her fiancé happy or otherwise. Nor did she know how she would handle herself should the day come when he was no longer excited by the prospect of sleeping with her, when he would go on to bed the next woman who titillated him. His heart in the palm of her hand might act as insurance against this infelicitous eventuality. But where was the path to his heart? Did he have great trolls guarding it? Perhaps a fire-spewing dragon chained before the castle gate? Assuming that was, the ideal gentleman had a heart at all. "I'm in your debt, sir," Louisa told Lord Renworth the next time she saw him. A week had flown by since the day he was presented to her family. During that time, Frederica made a quick appearance at the afternoon tea party Lady Balfour had hosted to welcome the Cantwell ladies to London, and she'd gone to the dressmaker's in an open carriage, wearing only a veiled hat that didn't do much to hide her face at all. "That is terrible. You will only ever be able to pay me with my own money," he said, as he handed her up into his carriage. It was pouring again. Since they were now affianced, however, he was allowed to fetch her from the bookshop on his own. "But joking aside, do you mean to tell me that my words had some effect on your sister?"
"Yes. She now has a mirror permanently attached to her right hand and studies herself constantly."
"Sounds like symptoms of a mental disorder."
With his walking stick, he knocked on the ceiling of the carriage to signal the coachman that they were ready to go. Louisa had not seen him with that particular accessory since they were last in the town coach together, before his proposal. She couldn't stop herself from staring a moment at its ebony handle. And he certainly didn't help matters by moving his thumb in a slow circle around that stylized jaguar head.
"Take your hand off it," she said. He looked at her with a half-smile that made everything inside her shift and drop, and set the walking stick aside. "Better?"
"No, not really. But what were you saying?"
He smiled again. "That your sister's new tendency to study herself constantly in a mirror sounds like an affliction."
"It does. But it is a much better affliction than the one she'd suffered for so long. We are all delighted, my mother especially. She is beginning to speak again of Frederica as the future spouse of a very wealthy man."
She looked at him sideways.
"In fact, she thinks rather wistfully of you as that very wealthy man. I believe she is ever so slightly embarrassed that you will have me instead, when she has so much prettier daughters."
"Your mother actually thinks that any of her other daughters could possibly hold the slightest temptation for me?"
She ought not to, but she adored the dismissiveness of his tone.
"That is a very smug smile on your face, my dear, dear Louisa."
"That is a very smug sensation inside my heart, my dear, dear Lord Renworth."
The carriage turned a corner, and his walking stick went sliding. They both reached out, but she caught it first.
"Maybe I ought to keep a better grip on it," he said.
She laid the walking stick across her lap.
"There, I'll make sure it isn't up to mischief."
He glanced at the walking stick for a fraction of a second longer than completely appropriate before he looked up into her eyes.
"By the way, our marriage settlement has been drawn up as we speak.
When you meet your solicitor again, he will tell you that you will have £5,000 a year in pin money.
She nearly dropped the walking stick. 5,000?
Don't be so loud, don't look so astonished, and don't, for goodness sake, appear grateful. I would not be able to show my face in society if it became known that my wife managed to squeeze only £800 a year out of me.
You offered me only 500, she said indignantly.
And you were the worst negotiator ever, asking for only 1,000 from a man who has 200,000 a year. Shame on you.
Her face heated. Well, you have always known that I am a country bumpkin.
I thought you were ambitious. You were certainly more ambitious where telescopes were concerned.
Your proposal caught me off guard.
Excuses, excuses, Louisa. Were I less mindful of my reputation, you would have been robbed.
Hardly. When she would have given him the £11.8 she'd studiously scraped together for emergencies, just so he didn't withdraw his offer. Still, £5,000 a year, just for her. She wanted to laugh. She was now her own rich man. Suddenly she remembered her deception. Goodness gracious, there was something I was going to let you find out for yourself after the wedding. But at £5,000 a year, my conscience won't let me keep quiet any more.
He cast her a sidelong look. So your conscience was fine at £800 a year?
Did you really think my conscience was the thought that couldn't be told to keep quiet when only £800 a year was a stake?
True. Morally upstanding you are not. So what dastardly secret am I going to find out now?
Was that fondness in his voice? Why did she feel as if she were slowly melting? I employ an array of bust improvers.
He shrugged, unperturbed. So do at least half of the ladies in London. God does not make that many perfectly waspish figures.
Well, my bust improver doesn't so much improve my bust as create one where none exists.
He glanced at her bosom. So how much of that is actually yours?
25%? 35% at most.
His eyes widened.
I apologize.
Only sorry to be caught, I see.
Well, I always did plan to make up for it.
How? Was that a barely suppressed smile in his voice? Isn't it a bit late for you to develop a bigger pair?
I once heard Lady Balfour talk about her brother-in-law's mistress. She said the woman was completely flat-chested, but was willing to take part in all kinds of unnatural acts.
He made the sound of choked laughter. Sorry, go on.
So I thought, she pulled at her collar, I thought if I would consent to unnatural acts, then perhaps it would not be so difficult to achieve my husband's forgiveness in this matter. And, well, you are most certainly the sort to incline toward unnatural acts.
Am I?
Are you not? She couldn't tell whether she was asking out of hope or apprehension.
He didn't answer her. Suppose you had become engaged to Mr. Pitt instead. Would you have just remained silent on the matter?
I would have started putting on progressively less exaggerated bust improvers and hoped that he didn't notice. But if he did, there were always the unnatural acts.
He might never again believe anything you say the rest of your life.
She was hardly worried about Mr. Pitt. What about you?
I have never trusted a word you said since the very beginning.
I do tell the truth sometimes, she pointed out, half pouting. Besides, now that I have ensnared myself a rich lord, and confessed my sins regarding my undergirding, I have no more lies to tell.
Is that what you think marriage is? A hotbed of honesty and transparency?
Well, no.
Exactly. If I know you, you will go on lying, bust improvers or no.
Then why did you propose to me? It always came back to this central mystery.
the seemingly benign puzzle at the foundation of her current good fortune.
"Because you will never have headaches," he answered in apparent seriousness.
"I beg your pardon?"
His lips quivered. "Nothing. Just know that I am looking forward to being the most happily married man in the Empire."
He smiled at her, and it was such a gorgeous smile that a few moments passed before she remembered that she, too, never trusted a word he said. Why had Felix proposed to her? He had not answered her because he was coming to the realization that it was impossible to prevaricate when he couldn't pin down the truth, like affixing the position of stars in the sky. If one didn't know where one stood, the exercise became futile. An accurate knowledge of the truth was, for him at least, a necessary starting point for any well-crafted lie. He, who could look people in the eye, smile, and spin a perfect yarn on the spot, was dodging her question because he had failed to find the real reason behind his action. Was it merely because his conscience itched over what he'd said about Lord Firth? Because he pitied her? Because he'd always planned on marrying a country bumpkin anyway, and she was as good as any rosy-cheeked girl he could have in 20 years? He was able to become the ideal gentleman because he knew every last one of his faults intimately, and therefore understood exactly how he ought to misdirect attention and create illusions. But now he had based one of the most important decisions of his life on a shifting foundation. Perhaps more alarmingly, he almost didn't care. Not when there were bust-improver-sized revelations to be had. The knowledge gave him a secret elation, an expansive pleasure, so that when they parted that day he told her, "Go on wearing those bust-improvers. In fact, have some bigger ones made." Her expression of befuddlement and suspicion was also a thing of joy. He further misdirected her attention by opening lines of credit at various establishments and gifting her mother a house that had 30 rooms. As if she weren't busy enough with a wedding breathing down her neck, she was now also required to inspect chairs, drapery, and side tables. "If you are trying to make me drop dead from exhaustion, you are not far from succeeding," she accused him the last time they saw each other before the wedding. No one else spoke to him as she did, with as much frankness and, could he call it affection? Yes, he decided. Exasperated affection, but affection all the same. "Will you ever stop suspecting me of ulterior motives?"
"Yes, when you stop harbouring as many of them as a Medici Pope."
"Then whom will you suspect for fun?" he answered cheerfully.
He usually enjoyed himself around people. Her company, however, he adored. And tomorrow they would join in matrimony for as long as they both should live. He had been trying not to think of the wedding night. No need to torment himself lusting after what would soon be his. But sometimes he couldn't quite help the direction of his thoughts. Dear, dear Louisa was in for a night to remember. She cleared her throat.
"You said you'd come to give me my wedding present."
So she'd caught him ogling her. Forgivable for a man the day before his wedding.
"Your wedding present is currently being set up in the conservatory at Huntington. After all your sisters and your mother each told me separately about the telescope, I had no choice but to buy one exactly like the one that slipped from your fingers."
Her eyes narrowed dramatically.
"You mean you wouldn't have bought it for me on your own?"
"Of course not. I'd have bought you a much better one, but now you are stuck with your heart's desire."
A scowl turned into a smile.
"Well, I can live with that."
People smiled at him all the time, but when she did it, he felt supremely accomplished. The thought gave him pause. Wasn't that how he had felt earlier, when he'd made her testy? He ignored that particular insight.
"But it is hugely unsatisfying to be told that one's present is hundreds of miles away, so I brought you this."
He took out a book from his pocket and handed it to her.
A telescope is useless unless you know what you are looking at.
The book was a first edition copy of Catalogue des Nébuleuses et des Amas d'Étoiles, otherwise known as Messier's Catalogue. She frowned, and suddenly he stood chest deep in uncertainty, not knowing how his present would be received, fearing that it would be cast aside as soon as he left the room. It wasn't even a real gift, just something he had taken from his study at Huntington on his way out to meet the train, after he was satisfied that the telescope had been correctly set up, because he thought it would please a girl who loved the stars.
"Don't worry if you can't read French."
His tone was stilted and formal.
"There are far more comprehensive catalogues and star maps published these days."
"I'm sure there are better works published these days, but this is the one I have always wanted to have," she said, her eyes downcast, her fingers rubbing against the binding of the catalogue. He wasn't sure he believed her.
"Then why do you look so consternated?"
She turned the book around once in her hands. "Because it disconcerts me that you can so easily guess my heart's desire." All the apprehension drained away, replaced by a startling buoyancy. How silly he'd been to be prey to such needless concerns.
"I am to be your husband. I should be able to read your heart's desire."
She looked up, her gaze meeting his. "You are the sort of man who is just as likely to grant a woman her heart's desire as to torment her with it." And she was the one woman who knew that he was the furthest thing from the ideal gentleman, yet still wept when she thought he would never have anything more to do with her.
"May I remind you that you were willing to take me and my lady-tormenting ways for a measly £800 a year?"
That brought a reluctant smile to her face. "I haven't been able to make a single good decision since I fell in lust with you." Her sexual infatuation with him had always gratified him immensely. Yet for some reason, this iteration of the fact didn't thrill him as much as it usually did. It was as if he wanted more. What more, he couldn't say. If the girl was any more willing, they would be copulating in the streets. Perhaps he was simply impatient to at last pin her underneath him and watch her face as her pleasure gathered.
"I will leave you to study your new book, then."
As he turned to go, she took hold of his hand. They touched as infrequently as they ever did, and the sensation of her skin on his was almost numbing in its intensity. "I do not mean to imply that I am not grateful," she said.
"But you are not," he pointed out.
"I am,"